1 know. And 44 is Channel 5. That's probably why you don't have any problems getting that at really any time. Let's pass it over to Malcolm. I guess he had a comment about the TV reception and low-level signals. Back to you, Dick.
Good information, Joe. You got it, Mel.
Hey, just to say, once in a while, they also, you know, have an old TV, somebody or something, pick up and all. I just want to see if it's still working, just to get an idea. The simplest way is I have a VCR still sitting there with a tape in it, which, of course, puts out a signal on either Channel 3 or Channel 4. So it's a good way you can check if you want to. Joe asked about checking the old TV operating, whether it's operating or not. Either that or if you have the availability, which is a lot of them around, they're very cheap, you see them a lot of times, being literally almost thrown out, is the color bar generators that we use for, you know, setting up televisions that also, you know, broadcast an RF signal on to Channel 3 or 4 with color bars, cross-hatch, whatever you want. So that's two good sources if you want to use for comparison, Joe, over.
Well, that's fine. The colors actually look good when I got a good viewable signal off the converter box at normal level. The color was good on the TV. I wasn't specifically going to go out and get one of the things just to test the TV with, but it was nice to know. And I was able to see stuff like one channel that's out by me that's still broadcasting in analog, and it had a color picture on it, even though it just sits to a test pattern. But that tells me the UHF section of the tuner was working okay also. Okay. I think that's all I had this week for questions, Dick. K2RW in TechNet, WH4YY.
Yeah, thank you, Joe. And you're giving me more and more enthusiasm. If it wasn't for a couple of high priorities I've got where I'm having trouble keeping up with my life, I've got to keep my clients happy, and they're going through a couple of crises, and there's a couple of fancy things going on in my house. So an awful lot of the normal ham radio things that I'd like to be doing, I'm not doing. Okay, we've got a DX station. Daniel from Lantana, Florida. And Daniel, wait a couple of seconds after you key up before you start talking, because the machine's got a little bit of a delay, and then give us your question. KC2, Lima Uniform, Lima Yankee Uniform, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Daniel.
Hi, Dick, it's KC2, LY from West Palm Beach. Dick, I'm still got the 7-Eleven radio, the Kenwood, I love it, I use it. And Mel, I miss you, and Dick, I miss you for 3 years. And remember another thing, I'm talking a little bit too fast. You're talking about the satellite dish, the big one. I got it here in my backyard, about the house. Tell me what I'm going to do with that big satellite dish. Over.
Yeah, my favorite 2-meter all-mode base station rig is an old-fashioned Kenwood TS-711A. That's what you're listening to right now. That's got the world's best frequency synthesizer I've ever seen. It's got a built-in power supply. And when it comes to hitting converters, if you're a person that gets on 1296, 2304, 10 gigahertz, and so on, 144 megs is the most universally used tunable IF for transmitting transverters. And the nice thing about this Kenwood TS711 is it's got a knob on the front panel where you can dial in anywhere from 0 to 30 watts of power output, from 1 to 30 watts of power output. So it's a very convenient rig with a carrying handle on the side, built-in power supply. The only thing wrong with it is it's not as compact as a normal 2-meter mobile rig, although it will run on 12 volts as well as 110. So it could easily be used mobile, but it's not as compact. However, it's got a lot of these other features, very clean sideband, the world's best synthesizer, and all these other characteristics, digital coded squelch built in and whatever, 30 memories and so on. In its day, it was a very hot rig. And you try to buy something of equal quality today, it's going to cost you $1,500, $1,800. And these things on the used market quite often sell for numbers like $300, $350. I don't care if it's been thrown down a flight of stairs and it's got a dented case. To me, it's a real old goodie, if you know what I mean. See, you've got a good one there. how are you going to use that great big satellite dish in your backyard, Daniel? KC2, LYU, KQRIW in the SickNet. Wait a couple of seconds before you start talking to make sure we don't miss the beginning of your conversation.
Roger, KC2, LYU, West Palm Beach. Yeah, I put the house and suddenly left here a big dish. It must be 8 footer. And I don't have the cover. I'd like to get the cover. I hold the cover, but it's the wrong cover, so I can't use it. Now, if we can't use the cover, maybe we can use it something to use in a diesel head. I don't know what. Back to you.
Yeah, I should be able to answer that question for you, and I'm a little unhappy that I can't, Daniel. I own a TVRO, in other words, the so-called 8 or 10-foot diameter dish, television receive-only terminal for direct satellite reception, which was popular 15 or 20 years ago. I own one of those, and the dish is operational. My converter needs repair, and I haven't gotten around to repair it. It's just another one of the things that hasn't bobbled to the top of my priority list. When it comes to free-to-air television, satellite television, I am of the belief that there's still a significant number of channels to watch. An awful lot of the channels are now scrambled, and you have to buy a particular service. But I still think on both C-band and KU-band, I still think that there are a number of operating channels with some good free programming to watch. If anyone's within the sound of my voice is watching TVRO, direct satellite reception these days, not the little 18-inch dish. I'm talking about the great big dish type satellite. If anybody is doing that right now today and knows how many of the channels are available, please give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. Looks like there's nobody on channel right now, Daniel, that's going to tell us. There's probably a website we can search. I know that there used to be a number of websites that would list all of the direct broadcast channels, the KU band and C band, television receive only, only TVRO, television receive only terminal frequencies, the big dish type. There used to be a number of websites where they would tell you which birds have how many channels, what service is it, and whether or not it's free to air as opposed to being scrambled. So by way of a web search, I know you and I can find out. I wish I had my converter operational because I'd like to be watching some of those channels. I'm the one guy in my town who does not have cable TV service or the equivalent. I watch television over the air, broadcast, or not at all. It's just a pride thing. When you've got a high piece of property and a lot of towers, why would you want to buy the service if you know what I mean? All I've got to do is put a rotator on my tower, and even with digital television, I should be able to watch digital television from the 4 or 5 nearest states. So good luck with that project, and you and I are both going to be getting a converter operational at about the same time, Daniel, if we're successful. KC2LYU, K2RIW on the TechNet. Good luck with that project, and come back and tell us how it works. You got it, Daniel.
I bought the converter someplace from Texas. I need another piece, number 2 converter, to run it. I got the one running to turn up the antenna left and right, up and down. I got it. And I got the converter. I forgot the number now. I'm supposed to get another piece, and I get 300 channels. I can get New York, I can get Paris, I can get the space, but somebody on my neighbor, he gets picture from the space, and that's why I want the dish.
Question. We'll get to your question in a minute, Wesley. Watching Space, which is NASA Select TV, which is my favorite channel when I had my satellite system working. That's a real fun thing to watch, and so whenever there's a space shuttle launch or whenever anything is going on the International Space Station, NASA Select TV will show that picture live, and it's only a couple seconds old, if you know what I mean, the amount of time it takes for the signal to get to the ground and back up and down to another satellite before you see it. So what you're watching is only a second or two old, and you're watching the astronauts essentially live, and that's fun to do. So I've got to get that system operational. I can't think of the name of the company right now in Thief Falls, Minnesota. I think it's the name of the location, which sells satellite receiving equipment. It's a TV channel. I keep forgetting the name of the
Skyvision Antuio.
Rich, give us that name again.
Skyvision Antuio.
Rich, you keep speaking first and keying the mic second, and we keep missing it. Key the mic, wait a second, and tell us again the name of that company.
Skyvision. Sorry, Dick. Skyvision.
That's it. Skyvision. If you go to Skyvision, and I guarantee they've got a website, they send you a beautiful free catalog, Daniel, Skyvision. They'll show you a catalog of all the stuff that you can buy, and they give you a lot of information. They give you a map of where all the satellites are, what services are on those satellites, which ones are free to air, and so on. You get a lot of information free of charge when you go to Skyvision. And thank goodness Rich knew that. So, Daniel, I recommend you go to Skyvision, request that free catalog from them. Guarantee they've got a website. You'll get a lot of information. Back to you, Daniel, for any fills on that. KC2LYU, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Roger, I'm scared to kiss the mic. Deck, I got it the same company. He gave it in the wrong box. The tow buckets in the wrong boxes. So nothing we can do. So I got to wait another couple months, and I get another box. It's three pictures. You're going to give it to me three pictures. I can watch all over to Europe and the space. And maybe another couple months. When I get it, I'm going to call you back. Deck, back to you.
Daniel, you should do that. We're looking forward to you calling us back in a month or two on all of those channels you're going to be watching. You're going to be watching NASA Select, which I think requires an additional converter, but I'm not sure about that. And yes, there is European television. There's a lot of television. When my TVRO was working, I had something like 300 channels to watch, lots and lots of information, free of charge. A lightning strike came along a few years ago. The power supply on my converter got damaged. I never got around to repairing it, even though I bought the service manual. It's another one of these projects. Wesley, it sounds like you've got a question on this one. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Yes, and how would you convert, how would you make the active element of the old high dish satellite antenna to operate on 2 meters.
I'm not sure you want to operate it on 2 meters. The way the old dish system works is that the television channels, and there were, I think, 24 channels from 3.8 to 4.2 gigahertz. Each channel was roughly 70 megacycles wide. And the odd channels and the even channels overlapped each other by 50%. And so a 70 megacycle wide video channel, FM modulated, that's a very special piece of equipment. It's not expensive, but to homebrew that, it's like trying to homebrew an 80 through 10 meter single sideband transmitter. You can buy it with a week's salary, but it would take you a man year to build it. You don't want to build it. And the same thing here. You go to Skyvision, you buy one of their converters for a couple of $100s, and all of that electronics is there. It takes 3.7 to 4.2, converts it down to channel 3, so to speak, converts the FM modulated video into amplitude modulated video so that your old NTSC television set can tolerate it. So it's a very special converter. That's the C-band, 3.7 to 4.2, and the Ku-band is somewhere around 10 to 12 gigahertz, and again, 32 channels on each individual satellite. All of those channels are 70 megacycles wide. So you wouldn't convert that down to 2 meters. There's no way you could use that signal. Okay, we're beyond the time in which we should be going over to Mel's mailbag, so let's do that right now. K2KEY, what kind of burning questions have you had this week, Mel? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Just looking, see if I can find something of interest, especially from young people getting into this hobby. I get a lot of questions here, but as I said in the past, we can't handle a lot of certain specialized situations, especially if it crosses over to commercial or for people that are in some kind of a business or a study, advanced study in electronics. We cannot really critique manuscripts, whatever. It seems to be I constantly still get emails about it. Hold on, let me see. All right, here's one. Let me let it drop. Okay, I'm studying to get a higher grade of amateur radio license. And some of the terminology that keeps popping up completely throws me. For instance, they keep coming up with this abbreviation IF. Is that IF meaning something? I think he's, the way he put it, is he put an IF in lowercase, it's actually uppercase. So I assume he wants to know, what is an IF? What does an IF mean, Dick? Over.
Yeah, I think it was Mr. Armstrong. I'm not sure now. Was it Armstrong who invented Super Heterodyne? In the old days, the way you built a receiver, and they called them a TRF receiver, Tuned Radio Frequency Receiver, is you had a bunch of stages between the antenna and the rest of the radio, which were tuned to the incoming frequency, and all of those stages all had to track each other as you tuned from the low end of the band to the high end of the band, and the final stage, you detected the signal, and out came the audio. That was the old-fashioned way of building a radio in 1915, we'll say, and it had a lot of disadvantages. And along came, I think it's Mr. Armstrong, who invented Super Heterodyne, where there is a local oscillator and mixer in the front end, which takes your RF frequency, converts it down to a lower frequency called IF. IF stands for intermediate frequency. And so now all of the stages of the rest of the radio are all tuned to the IF frequency. For instance, an ordinary AM radio, the one that tunes the 1.5 megacycles down to 0.5 megacycles roughly, that radio, almost all of those, uses an IF frequency of 0.455 megacycles, 455 KC. So there's a local oscillator above the RF frequency, mixing the RF frequency down. If, for instance, I was listening to Winds 1010 New York, 1.1 megacycles, and I tuned the local oscillator, 455 KC higher, which would be roughly 1.55 megacycles, the difference between those two is 455. That's what the mixer output would be, and all the rest of the stages of the radio are operating at 0.455 megacycles, the IF frequency.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Because all the rest of the stages of the radio are at a lower frequency, it's easier to get gain, it's easier to get good filtering, because the frequencies are different than the RF amplifier frequencies. The radio doesn't have to have high isolation between the input stages and the intermediate stages. It's not going to feedback and oscillate because they operate on different frequencies. So there's a zillion advantages you get with using the so-called Super Heterodyne technique, which uses IF. Intermediate frequencies are operating in the middle of the radio after the RF amplifier, after the mixer. Then you've got the IF frequencies and those amplifiers and filters. Then comes the detector and the audio amplifier and the loudspeaker. And now you've heard a block diagram of the whole Super Heterodyne receiver. A beautiful invention. And thank goodness that was done, in the roughly 1915 or so time frame. And almost all the radios we have used for the next 100 years are going to be using that technique. The best way of designing a radio anyone has ever invented, in my opinion. I bet you fell in love with it also, Mel. K2KEY, I'm Super Heterodyne Man from way back, K2RIW in the tech desk.
Yes, well, this was a big jump, of course, because you're talking about the old, what they was called direct conversion receivers, where the RF conversion took place in one huge step. The signals were mixed by the from the antenna with the local oscillator, and the local oscillator operated almost the same frequency as the incoming signal, and it put it right away. And the way I deal with to get it so close that it put it right into the audio range for what we call immediate demodulation. However, as Armstrong and Dick said, came along, and he said, I got a better idea, and he came up with the Super Heterodyne, which basically took the RF, radio frequency, that's just the RF, picked up at the antenna, and converted it at that, to a lower frequency prior to what I just said, demodulation. Demodulation is the end product, basically, where we start to really get it down to what we're listening to, audio range. So, what he came up with, let it drop. He came up with, basically, the conversion would take place, and as Dick said, in what we call the mixer stage. It was the signal coming in was mixed at that point with what we call the LO, local oscillator. That just meant that the sum or the difference of it presented to the output of the mixer, the IF frequency, and as Dick would just mention, 455 kilohertz, was very popular. It's still around. But what happens is the IF is usually high enough coming out of the mixer to be still considered RF, but it may be much lower in signal levels than the antenna, than the signal coming in from the antenna. So what you do is you have these IF amplifiers, a couple of stages of IF amplification, so that we can bring up the signal level. So that is the derivation. And then, of course, we proceed into demodulating it, putting it in audio filters or going straight into an audio amplifier. I think that I covered pretty good, Dick. Over.
VH4YY.
Show recognized, and yes, you covered it very well, Mel. You pick up some huge advantages, and that is when you tune across the dial on various frequencies, you may have to do a little bit of changing of the RF amplifier in the front end, and you change the LO frequency. Just two things have to change. All the next two, three, four stages of the receiver, the IF stages, no longer have to be tuned. They sit at one frequency. The detector that gets the envelope of amplitude of the IF signal and converts it to audio, that doesn't have to change. Everything else is fixed, and it becomes a much more compact, easily made design, and so the pocket transistor radio became very possible because of the Super Heterodyne technique. Know also that when it comes to that IF frequency selection, whether or not you use a high IF frequency or a low IF frequency, there is all kinds of pluses and minuses of advantages and disadvantages. That's a matter of how you do the design and what you want to do. Let me drop. Know also that you could, if you want to, make the IF frequency zero. It's called a direct conversion receiver, where the local oscillator and the incoming signal are on the exact same frequency. That is the method of operation of almost every one of the receivers that pick up your signal for easy pass or pick up the signal for RFID, radio frequency identification. These little tags that they put on clothing and food and other valuable products in a supermarket, for instance, these IF tags, you're going to be seeing more and more of those. Almost every one of those receivers uses a so-called direct conversion, zero IF. And that's another kind of design which you could say is the next step beyond what Mr. Armstrong did with his superheterodyne. Lots of ways of doing it. There's a lot of ways of converting signals in a receiver, and some of these receivers do the superheterodyne process twice, a so-called dual conversion. There are receivers where the first intermediate frequency is 8.9 megacycles, and there's a second mixer and a second local oscillator that then brings it down to a second IF of 455 KC. And there's advantages of doing that. Joe, to B2RYY, go right ahead. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Hi, Dick. I heard that they were using TRO receivers, TRF receivers, as late as World War II because of some applications, like especially submarine usage. They found that somebody figured out pretty quickly that the enemy could tune into your local oscillator and sort of DF you without even realizing what was going on. So they were still used, I think, at the World War II era, weren't they?
Absolutely. TRF receivers, where all of the stages track the incoming signal. So if you want to tune from the low end of the band to the high end of the band, and you've got seven stages of amplification, all seven stages, you have to vary the capacitor on them, so to speak, so that they all track. It's a big pain in the neck to design a receiver like that. But yes, that receiver now is a pure passive receiving device. It has no local oscillator. There's no other signal coming out of it that can be picked up. The modern-day military pieces of electronics all use superheterodyne, and they go through a heroic effort to make sure that the local oscillator is very well shielded, to make sure that the RF amplifiers and mixer stages are operating in a unilateral manner. That means the signal flows through in the desired direction, and that no signal is allowed to flow backwards in the undesired direction, where you would be re-radiating your local oscillator signal and transmitting your location, beaconing your location, and letting the enemy know what signal you're listening to and where you're located. So all modern-day receivers tend to be superhet, but there's very careful procedures used to make sure that none of that local oscillator can leak out to the outside world. And there's one other funny thing going on. Let me drop. Because many of these submarine communication systems operate at super low frequencies, like maybe 50 kilohertz. As such, you wouldn't want to convert that to a lower frequency with superheterodyne. You would receive that directly as a TRF receiver is one approach, or you might upconvert. There are cases where the intermediate frequency is higher than the incoming frequency. At first, you would think that you get the major advantages for converting to a lower IF frequency than the RF incoming frequency. Well, there are a few cases where upconverting is very popular and the right thing to do. Almost every spectrum analyzer that's made for microwave operation, the very first band is operating from roughly 0 to 2 kilohertz, and almost every one of those spectrum analyzers, the very first stage of mixing is an up converter, where the IF frequency is something like 2.3 gigahertz, so that 0 to 2 gigahertz gets up converted to 2.3 gigahertz as the intermediate frequency where all the rest of the amplification and signal analysis takes place. There's a huge advantage of doing that as far as having no image response and also having a flat response, no image response. There's a whole bunch of advantages of doing that, even though at first it seems opposite from common sense. Almost every good spectrum analyzer, the very first lowest frequency range is an up conversion to the IF or intermediate frequency. Any further comments on this one, Joe? The V2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet?
And do they use up-converting on just the spectrum analyzer, or is it to practically use it on receivers, too, that operate at very, very high frequencies in the gigahertz range?
The whole reason why you use up conversion on the very first lowest band of a spectrum analyzer is because when you go from 0 hertz essentially, it's really a couple of kilohertz, up to 2 gigahertz in the very first band, and maybe the next band goes from 1.8 to 4, and the next band goes from 3.9 to 10, and so on. But the advantage of doing that is that you realize that when you go from essentially 0 to 2 gigs, you're transversing a large number of octaves. If you tried to do that with ordinary superhet down conversion, where you would have image and real responses all over the place, interpreting the screen and finding out who's real and who's phony would be very difficult. The very first spectrum analyzer covering that frequency range was the Hewlett-Packard 8555. That was my competitive spectrum analyzer when I was in the spectrum analyzer design world way back in 1969, 1970. And because that was using a first IF of something like 220 megacycles that had image and real signals all over the place on the first band, therefore there was a button on the front panel called Signal Identifier. You press the button, the real signals would move over one box to the right, the image signals would move one box to the left, the second harmonic signals would move 2 boxes to the right, and so on. Well, as long as you've got a simple signal going in, the signal identifier did a pretty good job. You put a comb generator into that spectrum analyzer, the whole screen lights up with thousands of signals. They all move in various ways as you press the signal identifier, and you can't figure out what the heck is going on. So it took the up conversion technique of more modern spectrum analyzers than that 1980, let's say,
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Yeah, that was a Hewlett-Packard, roughly 1965, 1970 product. And so once up conversion became more popular, and the AIL 707 spectrum analyzer that I worked on was one of the analyzers using this up conversion technique, where all of those images and funny signals disappeared, and life became a lot simpler. You no longer needed a signal identifier. So the choice of intermediate frequencies, whether it be a lower frequency and they call it down conversion, or a higher IF frequency where they call it up conversion, or a direct conversion receiver, which is zero IF, there's all kinds of advantages and disadvantages of each approach depending on how much spectrum you got to cover, the nature of the signal you're listening to, the center frequency, and so on. When it comes to designing radio receivers, my goodness, are there a lot of ways of doing it. K2KEY, K2RIW. Go ahead, Mel.
Comment?
Go ahead there, Wesley.
Enter Sheehan. I just have sent you the email with the extra low frequency or very low frequency receivers made by him, radio amateurs, just worth mentioning.
Okay, so while we're running the TechNet, Wesley is sending me emails which you would like me to analyze. I've only got one head and two hands, but I'll try. Mel, go ahead. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yep, the final word on it, on superheterodyne, that by 1942, the military, the War Department, the Army, the whole works, made sure that any manufacturer of receivers for the government had in the front end a RF amplifier and an elementary designed RF filter of the time. And that was because they got hip to the knowledge that the receiving position was being located by the local oscillator, many times coupling back into the antenna. So all those spy radios that, in fact, I knew a gentleman worked for at that time for Homelin, I think it was Homelin. Yeah, Homelin Radio, I think he worked for. He was making those radios that they stuck in the bottom of suitcases and all for the, at that time, the OSS Office of Strategic Services, that forerunner of the CIA, smuggling spies behind enemy lines and send information back, and that's how they, many times in the early days, they've got caught, because the local oscillator was sending a signal back up to the antenna, and they were able to use that as a way to locate them. But that's it. They updated the receivers to have this one stage added RF amplifier and elementary type of filter, and that was took care of that situation, Dick. Should we go on?
Yeah, go ahead with one more, Mel.
Okay, here we are. All right. I made a mistake. I sat my handy talkie out in the sun, and all of a sudden I found something went wrong with the display. It looked like this display went completely black. Is this normal for these types of displays? Okay, you want to tell them about liquid crystal? This is a typical liquid crystal LCD problem, Dick. Over.
The good news about a liquid crystal display is that they require extremely little power to make them go from black to white, each one of the little segments. The good designs are operational in the bright sunlight, so it's a very low power, very high visual display, sometimes with backlighting so that it works in the dark, and very little, as I said, very little power, high visibility, high contrast, and so on. That's the good news. You take a liquid crystal display and put it in a freezing environment like minus 40 degrees centigrade, it will experience permanent damage. It will not work correctly after that. You put it in bright ultraviolet sunlight so that it goes to a certain temperature. You put it into a hot automobile where all the windows are rolled up in the summertime in Florida and the car goes to 180 degrees Fahrenheit and it's cooking your upholstery. You go to super high temperatures, super bright ultraviolet radiation, or super cold temperatures. Any of those will take a liquid crystal display and probably permanently damage it. And I don't think there is a recovery procedure. I think the recovery procedure in many of those cases is to buy a brand new liquid crystal display, take out the old one, and install the new one. In the case of a device like your iPod, let me drop, your 3-generation and 4-generation and iPod and iPad and whatever, these little handheld devices, to remove that display and replace it is a big deal. It's not easy. So be careful with that display. Don't stab it. Don't let it get exposed to super high, super low temperatures, and so on. I don't think there's a recovery. What do you think, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW?
If it's not for a long period of time, you most likely, if you put it in a darker space, in many cases it returns to normal, Dick. I don't know, do they sell any kind of a filter paper, you know, like a plastic overlay, to help prevent that situation? For instance, you want to take your handy talkie out onto the beach or whatever. I'm very careful to make sure it stays in its carrying case, which covers over the display when I take my handy talkie out with me, especially in the summertime out to the beach. But I was just wondering, maybe there's a marketed type of filter for that situation, over.
There's many kinds of plastic you can put over a display which will filter out ultraviolet, and I think that will help. I'd like to believe that most liquid crystal displays, for a reasonable length of time in sunlight, do not become damaged. But if you lay it in the sunlight in such a way where direct sunlight is hitting it for a long period of time and the temperature of the display itself goes above, let me pick a number, 140 degrees Fahrenheit. Or if you leave it out in super cold weather, where the temperature goes below, let me pick a number, minus 30 degrees centigrade, 30 degrees Fahrenheit. In either of those temperature extremes, you're subject to creating significant damage. I have a number of liquid crystal displays on digital voltmeters that have been partially damaged because of being put into super cold environments. So for a reasonable length of time, ultraviolet exposure I don't think is damaging. I think it's the thermal increase in temperature created by direct sunlight for a long period of time. That's what I think is the damaging phenomena there, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, do you know of any kind of sunglasses, something of that sort, that could be put over the display so that it still be somewhat visible and yet be protected? Can you think of something, or am I just making a facetious joke and saying that an old pair of one lens out of an old pair of sunglasses or something of that sort, these cheapy glasses that sometimes you see them, which is just like a piece of plastic with a rubber band over.
Back in the days when people used chemical film, Kodak film, which in many cases, some of the kinds of film were very ultraviolet sensitive and would give you a kind of a washed out picture. And if you put a 1A filter on the front of your camera, that problem went away. The 1A filter, when you look at it, has an extremely slight yellowish tint to it, which is almost unnoticeable. But it does remove essentially all ultraviolet. So you can buy rattan filters, in other words, these simple pieces of flexible plastic, which are called a 1A filter type, and you can mount them into any kind of a holder you like. And so to buy 1A rattan filter from the Kodak company, among others, they used to sell it, and there's probably other photographic houses that will sell it today. And some of the photo-coupled diode-type mosaics that are in modern-day solid-state cameras, some of those are also ultraviolet-sensitive or infrared-sensitive. So they put various kinds of filters in there. So I know you can buy filters which are visually 99% transparent and will protect your electronics from either infrared or ultraviolet. You can buy those kinds of filters and put them in front of your display, and I believe it'll give you some protection. But I think the real damage is thermal, too high a temperature or too low a temperature. I don't think ultraviolet creates bleaching of the display device itself. I know that the ultraviolet rays from the sun shining directly on your CD-ROM, your disk memory device, that can definitely, the writable ones which have a chemical action, that can definitely create damage. You don't want that to happen. But liquid crystal display, I don't think the ultraviolet itself does the damage. I think it's only the rise in temperature that's secondary.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I think it's only the rise in temperature that does it. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I basically know, you know, liquid crystal theory of how it works. It's with the sandwich film of, you know, liquid crystals between glass plates and the miniature corrugated roofing that they have on there, and then the molecules will, I can believe, line up on the ridges. So you rotate one plate by 90 degrees, the molecules near the plate will orient themselves at right angles to the molecule near the other plate, and so that forms basically the operation of the liquid crystal, I believe. The twist actually rotates the polarization of the light by 90 degrees as it passes, I believe, through the liquid crystal. I think, if I'm not mistaken, that's basically the theory of it. I know it's got it works by electrically unbalancing something of that sort. So, anyhow, all right. So, oh yes, very good idea. So that yellowish type of material that I see it was sold in, like plastic sheets. If I get them in small square plastic sheets or a full sheet, I've seen that many times. You say you could cut that and put it over the display and that will protect it, correct it?
Yes, if it's 1A type filter material, There's a, something called Sky Filter in 1A, which is a little bit more severe than the Sky Filter, a kind of material that was sold for a lot of years by the Kodak company, and I'll bet it still is, will protect whatever you've got from ultraviolet. Now, whether or not there's enough visual energy and infrared energy still coming through to thermally damage your liquid crystal display, whether it be your digital voltmeter or your display on your camera device and whatever, that's something else to be worried about. And by the way, liquid crystal displays, they do a kind of polarization. In other words, you've got a polarizing filter in front of the liquid crystal display, and when you put voltage on a particular pixel element, it takes those little particles in there and makes them line up in such a way so that the polarized light does or does not get through the polarizing filter. A very interesting experiment that I've done on a number of occasions is to take a beautiful, I've got a handheld calculator, my Hewlett-Packard 50, will give me computer-generated graphics on its screen. On a number of occasions, I've made a graph or a three-dimensional computer-generated graphics that I can rotate on the screen, and I wanted to show that to somebody, and therefore I put it in front of a copying machine or a scanner, and I wanted to scan that picture off the screen. I always got a blank display. In other words, the way the Xerox-like machine works is very different than the way your eye works. It's shining the light on the piece of paper at a crazy angle, and the liquid crystal display no longer functions correctly. So I have never succeeded in being able to make a copy on a photocopying machine of what appeared on my digital voltmeter or on my handheld computer. The liquid crystal display doesn't respond the same way as it does to the eye. K2KEY, go to another one if you want to, Mel. K2RIW in the deck mat.
Right, I want to experience that. I wanted to show it. So I wound up, I used an overhead projector, a regular one of these overhead projectors, basically show, get some kind of it. It wasn't really, didn't really produce real well because, you know, I was trying just to show it to multiple people, but you're right, you can't make really a copy of it. So one of those overhead projectors that had a camera type conversion that basically to a monitor system that they used in some instructions, that's the only thing that I was able to bring up the display large enough to demonstrate. I'm reading for another one. Well, here's one that I know I've gotten questions like this a number of times on the 10-meter version, too. Many times you mentioned, Mel, that you listen on 10 meters, and if it's dead, you just leave the receiver set on a frequency, and you have a display that tells you what is going on up and down the band, and you said you could hook this to any of your receivers. Would you please tell us what and kind of, where do you find this particular item? He's talking about my home-brewed spectrum, I guess you call it spectrum analyzer, as we were starting to discuss, or Panscope Dick, over.
For many years, those things were called Panadapter. Panoramic adapter is what Panadapter stands for. It was a Heathkit product that you could add to many receivers, particularly many of the Heathkit receivers. In some cases, what that did was to take the output of the very first mixer of the receiver on the first intermediate frequency, IF frequency, and display the whole bandwidth of the IF frequency range as a spectrum analyzer display. When it's set up correctly, you could be looking at the whole ham band, maybe the 20-meter band. You could be scanning from 14.2 to 14.4 megacycles inclusive, and any signal that appeared anywhere in that frequency range would appear as a pip, a vertical deflection, on that oscilloscope-like display. So the nice thing about a pan adapter is it allows you to look at essentially the whole band all at once, and you can find out, is there activity at the low end, the center, the high end? Is there a blank frequency that nobody is using that you can hop onto and start calling CQ during a contest? There's a lot of advantages in having a PAN adapter. In a case of a band like the 10 gigahertz ham band, which has a whole lot of bandwidth, and guys can be scattered anywhere around a 100 kilohertz region to slowly scan across that 100 kilohertz region over and over again, is very time consuming. To have the right kind of a panoramic display where you see it all at once, let me drop, can be very handy. And nowadays, by way of the audio operational board that's inside of computers, there is a program called Spectran, S-P-E-C-T-R-A-N or something like that, which also gives you a panoramic display across your computer screen when it's hooked up to the right kind of a radio receiver, the right portion of a radio receiver. So Spectran, or which can give you a kind of a waterfall display, which means that now you're seeing not only the low-end through the high-end frequency displayed from left to right across the screen and the signal strength being displayed as vertical pips, but the whole thing becomes a waterfall display where you can see what signals have popped up and disappeared over the last 30 seconds or over the last minute of operation by that waterfall display. So there's a whole art and science to display devices, which allows you to see a lot of data in a hurry across a whole lot of the amplitude frequency domain. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
So we have their comments.
Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, just wanted to say, I used two of those things here. They were very popular by Heathkit. The first one was known as a HO13 was the model number. HO13 Ham Scan by Heathkit. And then they came out with this, later on, the SB620 Ham Scan. I have one of each here, which I've restored to like new condition, Dick. And I use one of them with, one is not being used right now, but I'm not selling it, I'm hanging on to it. I'm using one with the KWM2A and the 62S1 on 6 and 2 meters. And Dick, when you're finished, if you have time for a question, I'd appreciate it, because I fell asleep earlier. I woke up about 10 to 9 when I came in there and gave you that information on SkyVision. Back to net, N2EO.
Okay, Rich, you're on the list, and glad you woke up with the SkyVision. I keep forgetting that name, SkyVision. Every time I need that, once every 6 months, I have to re-derive that name. Common name, I should be able to remember it. But I got a mental block on certain things, and that's one of them. Okay, back to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yeah, Rich, thank you for the info. Yes, Heathkit, I remember back, I believe they were little 3-inch monitors of some sort. They were complete units with a CRT in them. I believe they contained a number of tubes, vacuum tubes in them. My version is a homebrew version. I know that they are. They're asking here where I got the schematic from and the info. This is basically home design. It's a very simple device, similar to what Heathkit was putting out, but I've updated because of the availability of a lot of modern integrated circuits and all. It's more or less simplified putting such a device together, and I find that as you know, many people, it takes away that labor of situation of tuning back and forth when the bands are very quiet. So you're correct. You looked in the handbooks and all, you will not see it. For some reason, there's coverage in any of the ARRL handbooks, as far as I know, Dick, on a similar device. Many of the receivers do have an IF output where you can plug the right directly into. So I don't understand why, you know, it's like a neglected sort of part of the handbook, Dick, over.
Some of the older handbooks did have a pan adapter in there, Mel. It did appear for a short period of time in the earlier versions of the Radio Amateurs Handbook. Oh, I'm going to pick a number around 1975 or so. But they have to make some careful choices as to what they include and not include, but otherwise the Radio Amateurs Handbook would be 6 inches thick and cost $100. So as they add new material, they have to subtract something, and we'll always be arguing about whether or not the right things got subtracted. The panoramic adapters are not a popular item that many ham radio operators construct themselves. You can buy it as an accessory for many of the popular receivers, or you can buy a brand or model number of a receiver that has a pan adapter function built in. And that's the way we normally get it. We don't build our 80 through 10 meter sideband transceivers anymore. And by the same token, we don't build pan adapters anymore. We buy them. When it comes to microwave equipment, which there's not very much of it, yes, you do build it. When it comes to antennas, you build it. For certain kinds of electronics, it is not cost effective in dollars or time, in man hours, to build them anymore, because they're already 90% contained within a integrated circuit or in some kind of a module that you can buy that's ready to roll. Okay, let me do a quick scan to see if Paul is available. Is anything new going on in space? And if not, we'll go on to our deeper questions. WS2N, are you there, Paul? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Say one thing in final.
And I am here, Dick, WS2N.
Paul recognized. Go ahead, Mel.
Well, if you look at those early pan scopes that are still very popular, as Rich said, still in use, you're basically looking at a single conversion super heterodyne type of device. That's exactly what I built. It's basically just a super heterodyne with mixer set up IF output into a detection system. And they do have a number of articles to build your own receiver in there. So it's not much more, or even actually not much, there isn't anything more than adding the sweep generator, which they also have in a couple articles that to build them for filter evaluation. So if you take the sweep generator that they have in there for filter evaluation, combine it with the voltage control oscillator they show for doing the filter, in fact, the filter evaluation circuits they show in there is almost the entire pan scope, Dick. So I just don't know why that would be skipped. But all right, just basically that's what I was thinking, that it's a handy gadget, definitely. And yes, there are some commercial ones that you can purchase, but I guess some people have some of the old receivers and they would like to add it on. All right, anyhow, let's, I guess we'll, like you say, pick up Paul and we'll continue this later on. Go ahead.
The pan adapter that ends all pan adapters is the one that John, KC2WGB, now owns. It's a Hewlett-Packard 3583. I keep forgetting the model number, but it's called a dynamic signal analyzer. It is a kind of a pan adapter, which goes from essentially 0 to 100 kilohertz. To get it to work on a 455 KCIF, you'd have to do a little bit of up conversion. But that thing used as a pan adapter can be tuned anywhere across the 100 KC band. You can scan any section of it, and it has a digital signal processing input network, which allows you to generate a resolution filter. In other words, the scanning filter can be anything from, let me pick a number, 10 kilohertz wide, 5 kilohertz, 1 kilohertz, 100 hertz, 30 hertz, 10 hertz, 1 hertz, 100 millihertz, 50 millihertz, 10 millihertz. You can make a filter, digitally generated filter, inside of that dynamic signal analyzer that John owns, which can give you a filter down to 10 millihertz of bandwidth if you want to. And can that allows you to find weak signals in the noise? Wow. I remember borrowing one of those